I'm live on the scene here as the giant spaceship, which has been hovering over western Pennsylvania for 3 days, is setting down. Life forms are emerging, and I believe we're about to see first contact between them and the United Nations representative.
Greetings, astral travelers. I bring you a gift of air fresheners. They're shaped like little pine trees, which are pleasant things that grow here. And look, judging from the smell coming out of that thing, you're going to want all of these for the trip back.
We do not want this gift. We evolved beyond the sense of smell millions of years ago.
What do you want?
We want to know if these are the Jethro Tull albums. Robot, show them our collection.
Okay, let me just flip through. Minstrel in the Gallery, Songs from the Wood, The Broadsword and the Beast. I mean, you've got all 21 plus the vinyl EPs. March the Mad Scientist, that one is hard to get, and let's see, do you have the Japanese bootleg?
82874 with Locomotive Breath at the end. Yes, but my cousin borrowed it, and he never brings it back.
Then I would say, yeah, you have everything.
Then we will leave.
Wait, I mean, aren't we gonna have a scientific and cultural exchange?
You have nothing else that we want.
You prog rock guys are such snobs.
Stupid girl. Go back to your Billy Joel collection.
Okay, that is just so wrong. Music should be a force that reaches across galaxies to unlock our respective mysteries about existence. Like on all those Yes album covers. Also, I don't like Billy Joel, but perhaps a discussion of prog rock is the best we can hope for. And now, the guy who thought ELNP was a utility, Colin McEnroe.
Right, so I will just lay my cards on the table here, so to speak, and say that, you know, my story does begin sometime in the early 1970s. I mean, not my whole story, but my story about this begins in sometime in the early 1970s. And there were these Yes albums, and they had these Roger Dean covers that were very mysterious and intriguing and suggested this kind of Promethean secret that might be imparted through this music. And then the music itself was, I think it's fair to say, different from other stuff that anybody was listening to at that moment. And it kind of led to an awful lot of time. And I feel like, as we go through this today, that people's cars may be involved a lot. In my case, it involved riding around a lot in the back of Jimmy Alderman's copper-colored Pontiac Le Mans, where he had an 8-track player in the front, and where we would listen to Yes and King Crimson and McDonald and Giles, which is what you listened to if you really thought King Crimson had gotten a little too commercial, and stuff like that, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and we just thought it was freaking awesome, and maybe it still is, it very possibly still is. One of the questions that we're going to have today is how prog rock has held up, how progressive rock has held up. But you know, as I got into Jimmy Alderman's copper-colored Pontiac Le Mans with the 8-track player, here's basically what I heard. All right, I think you get the drift. And I just want to say, possibly worsening the whole experience, and I don't mean to indict anybody else or sound like Bill Clinton, but I was the only person in that particular car who was not high on the marijuanas. And I feel like being high on the marijuanas may have been kind of essential to really fully appreciating this. So the person you hear in the background is John Dankosky, executive editor of the New England News Collaborative and host of The Wheelhouse, which is tomorrow, and next on WNPR, which is Thursday. And he is also, it says here in the introduction, a huge nerd who intentionally listens to Rush. And yes, I didn't write that particular introduction. Also joining us from Washington, D.C. Is David Weigel, who's the author of The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock. So before we bring David Weigel aboard, John Dankosky, you're hearing this music. Not only are you hearing this music, but you are sitting there with the album cover in question right in front of you. So you have that with you.
I do.
And many other album covers besides, I might add.
Yes.
And so what did this music mean to you at the moment that you went through the gateway towards it?
Well, I'm glad you started with your story, Colin, because my story started 10 years after that, thereabouts. So it's in the 1980s. This music that you were riding around in the back of a car listening to in the early 70s was music that was not of my time, right? So we were listening to something different on the radio in the 1980s. And I was part of a group of sort of outcast high school kids who felt like what was normal wasn't fun. And so we were going to attach ourselves to something not normal. And what could be more not normal than music that feels like it's science fiction? It feels like it's fantasy. My gateway drug into this world was Peter Gabriel as the front man of Genesis, wearing costumes and singing songs that sort of made me think of the Chronicles of Narnia in a way that probably I should have grown out of by the time I was 14 or 15. But that's where I was at the time, and it all felt like a world that was my world, specifically because no one else, and certainly no girls in my high school, cared anything about whatsoever. And that's really how I got into it. And I stayed there for a lot of my life.
So let's fast forward to the present. And David Weigel, your book begins with, that was, by the way, the music that we were hearing was from Close to the Edge by Yes. Your book begins with a cruise to the edge. Tell us about the cruise to the edge. Who's on that cruise and what are they trying to get out of it?
Yes, it's not just a clever pun. Well, Yes, we're on the cruise, actually. Yes, we're the headliners. They still are the headliners in a version of the cruise that goes on every year. I went on the cruise in 2014 with Yes and Marillion as the co-stars, and a group of less famous progressive rock acts, young ones who were super interesting, bands like Moon Safari and from Sweden, and then variations on 70s classic groups that had reconfigurated, like Gentle Giants spinoff group Three Friends. And it was just several days, and I went in not wanting to be jokey and ironic, because it's just one of the easiest tropes in journalism, easy but expensive, to go on a cruise and make fun of it. It actually was this enlightening, embracing experience. I don't know where else I would have gone to see Mayan Ruins in Cozumel with Edgar from Tangerine Dream, but for this cruise. And days and days of being with people who lived and breathed this music were really informative for how I wrote the book. I already was about halfway done the book at that point, but I thought about things anew after that experience.
Who was on this cruise? I mean, by that I mean, I think I can sort of guess the age group, although John Dankosky would skew a little bit young, I'm assuming, for the age group. It's probably people, I'm in my early 60s, and I'm white.
you're a man.
I'm a man. I mean, and I would add, and because I think there's a little bit of class consciousness in this whole story, I'm college educated too. I just feel like I've now described the demographic, but then that's the kind of jokey, sardonic take that we're trying to avoid here, David Weigel. So who was on the cruise?
Well, it was a bit, you know, older than me. I'm 36 now, as of a couple months ago. I was one of the, I'd say, skewing younger members of the cruise. Average age maybe was more like 46 to 50. And really talented musicians. There were some people who were kind of like me, anoraks, who just liked the stuff and wanted to sit there and nod our heads as we listened. There were people who have learned from these musicians, write their own music. A thing I write about in the book that I found to be kind of powerful in a way I didn't expect were these nightly cover bands that would play in one area of the ship, where you could cover a Yes song, and Chris Squire, the bassist from Yes, who's unfortunately passed away, would walk out and listen and nod approvingly at how faithful and talented these people were. But guys who, maybe they're just a hobbyist in their garage, maybe they were with some bands that never quite made it. One guy was for-hire kind of wedding band player who then would just go in and completely shred these solos on songs like Gates of Delirium, which are not easy parts to play. And I just came away, I already appreciate the music, obviously, I was writing the book by that point, but just came away with this appreciation for a devotion to the craft of the music and the experimental nature of the music that you don't see with other rock super fans. So no patch on, you know, the person who goes to every Bruce Springsteen concert, but there seem to be more headbanging and singing along to lyrics, less picking apart how this stuff works and playing it yourself.
Well, so John, this is a big point about progressive rock, I think, which is that you can really enjoy Bruce Springsteen or any number of artists, and knowing a lot about time signatures, chord changes, and things like that won't really deepen your appreciation of their work that much. But it seems to me that the people who really enjoy progressive rock are people who know a lot about music, have learned, as David says, a lot about music through immersion in progressive rock, that there's a way in which that's kind of a feedback loop too.
Yeah, you want things that are complex that people, normal people, just can't play. The idea that anybody could pick up a guitar and play that, the ethos behind punk, is something that the prog rock fan kind of rejects. This notion that if it's easy, then we can put our emotions into it, is less important than the idea of something that has complexity and is going to set you apart in some way. Now, not all the music that we're going to talk about today is all that technically complex, but a lot of it, that's really its hallmark. I will say, as a high school kid who listened to this music and then tried to play it, I ended up being much more the Dave Weigel, sitting and listening and nodding my head. I tried like hell with my friends to play Rush and King Crimson and Yes songs, and we just weren't anywhere near good enough. But we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, what our album cover would look like if we had an album. We just didn't work that hard to actually try to play the music.
So I want to talk a little bit more about this, but John, I also just want to, maybe you can help me set this thing up, because I'm sure David is going to have a lot to say about it too. But there's a way in which Yes, like, I really liked Yes, and I had all these albums, and Yes, like, had sort of top 40 hits and stuff like that. There's a way in which there was a little bit less than met the eye to Yes, and a little bit a way in which ultimately they didn't fully subscribe to the progressive rock ethos, which I think is sort of about this intellectual and musical connoisseurship approach to music, and popular tastes be damned.
Yeah, I really love Dave's thoughts on this, but I think that one of the things that I really take away from the book is just how Yes was always kind of chasing money. They always were a little bit too big and a little bit too grand for their ability to draw a crowd, and they'd break up and they'd reform. But I think that some of the worst tendencies of progressive rock were all kind of embodied in this time period between the Close to the Edge record that we listened to and the next thing that they attempted to put on vinyl, Tales from Topographic Oceans, which I think David talks about in quite some detail in the book as being this sort of meandering, wandering, amorphous thing that neither the band nor the audience really wanted to hear. And I sort of think about that that Spinal Tap quote about there being a very fine line between clever and stupid. And I think that that's really what Yes was always walking at that time.
Right. There is, I don't know, David Weigel, there's sort of a two-tier system here in a way. And the other tier, and maybe we'll come to it in just a second, is different from Yes. There are people who are part of this world who just wouldn't be caught dead on a cruise ship in 2017.
Yeah, there are people like Robert Fripp, and there are some of the rock and opposition guys from Henry Cow. I don't think Fred Frith would be on this. There were musicians who did not like what progressive rock came to entail and what the description came to mean, and rejected the idea of there even being a description. They preferred, you know, they didn't prefer the terms. They didn't like the categorization. The people who got along with categorization, I found a couple of people did it in real time. More people did it afterward when it was kind of a useful qualifier for what kind of music you made. Packaged by radio, packaged by critics, and if you're in the position a lot of these artists come, you know, 2014, 2015, 2016, you're just trying to get gigs to make money. So you're happy to assign yourself that label. But a lot of musicians really dislike the label. I mean, I kept a pretty big net I threw over all of this to incorporate Mike Oldfield. I incorporate Krautrock, a lot of things. And there are people have gently criticized the book, not reviewers, but fans of the music, who think I should have cast an even wider net. But that's a debate I didn't really want to get into. The fans I talked to in the book, that was more my focus group of people who were devoted to this music for decades. And we're having a different debate over whether this or that piece of music now is progressive. It was the music that started in the late 60s and what grew out of that for the next couple decades, kind of tapering off when some of these artists began to pass away.
You know, John, I think there's also a real tension between commercial success and an artistry that also surfaces. Well, I think this form was partly made possible by something called AOR, Album Oriented Rock. There was kind of a revolution in radio that sort of said, well, now this big FM band has opened up. We don't just have to play 3-minute singles anymore. We can play all kinds of stuff, including stuff that people have never heard before, stuff that's way too long to go on other formats. And although that format commercialized pretty quick, there was a period of time where that notion, too, of what a song was kind of changing.
It was, and I think that still shows up today. I mean, in the classic rock radio of today, it's still quite possible to turn it on and hear Roundabout from Yes's Fragile album. It's very it's regular that you'd hear Jethro Tull. Not so regular that you'd hear some of the other bands that David outlines, including, I think, the band that many prog rock fans look to be the top of the heap and probably the heroic elements of David's book, King Crimson. I mean, you don't hear King Crimson songs on album-oriented rock radio back then, for the most part, with some exceptions, and you really don't hear them in classic rock radio now, but, you know, that's because they were after something else. They were after something that was a little bit more artistic and a little less commercially driven.
You know where you hear them? Right here. I bought this album when it came out, and we listened to in Jimmy Alderman's copper-colored Pontiac Clements as well on 8-track. So, Dave Weigel, say why it is. I mean, I think John has articulated. Both of you have talked a little bit about, you know, the difference between these two bands, but maybe say a little bit more, David Weigel, about King Crimson and what they do epitomize.
Mm-hmm. Well, King Crimson were among the bands I discussed that didn't like any kind of labels. They started as a project of Robert Fripp, Greg Lake, who's here you hear on vocals and bass on this track. Bill Bruford is,
Michael Giles.
Michael Giles on drums. And
were you just like lost in a fog of King Crimson memories right there?
No, sorry. I just, the reason I was late for this interview caught up with me, which was that I woke up at 4 to get the plane that was delayed to get here. Can you ask the question again?
Well, John, without the benefit of liner notes, can also walk us through this. So I'll let you compose yourself from your jet lag. I mean, yeah, so Robert Fripp is sort of the key name here, though, right?
Robert Fripp is the guitarist and the mastermind behind King Crimson. And at the start, this was a band. It was a band that was somewhat put together out of bits and pieces, but it was, when it first burst onto the scene, a really big thing, even sounding as heavy and weird and strange as that in the midst of a lot of free love and psychedelia in the late 1960s. But Robert Fripp became the only consistent member of King Crimson, and it really stopped being about being a band, and it started being about Robert Fripp and what he likes and doesn't like. A very good part of the story, I think, for a lot of people to understand is that after Yes became very popular and after they got an awful lot of album sales and they'd sold a lot of records, their drummer, Bill Bruford, as David said, left, yes, he was basically recruited by Robert Fripp to come into a new King Crimson because he wanted to do something new and turn it into a new kind of band. That song that we heard, Colin, it's like a template for a certain type of music that people really still love today. And it's sort of my contention. I think David traces back the history of prog rock a bit earlier to Procol Harum. But this is, I think, the first real thing that ever happened in prog rock, 21st Century Schizoid Man. And it's probably also the best, which maybe sets us up on a little bit of a weird path to have the pinnacle of something also be the very first thing that ever happens.
You know, there's so much I want to get into here, and but the show is flying by like a Rick Wakeman keyboard solo. No, it actually is flying by, unlike a Rick Wakeman keyboard solo. So, but you know, I think there's some other things going on here. I want to mention two or three of them. I guess before we do that, just so that we can make the argument or discuss the argument that this music, in fact, because it blew away all kinds of boundaries, it really kind of opened the landscape up, the Roger Dean landscape up, for all kinds of other experimentation that survives and prospers even today. So let's hear Kanye West. Music, no one man should have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours. Stop tripping, I'm tripping off the power. Although David Weigel, I think it's fair to ask, does this represent some kind of recognition by Kanye West of a musical thread running from Robert Fripp to him? Or is that just a really cool phrase to drop into your song?
I think it's a good sample. He's never explained the sample. I will say that I emailed him through all the channels I knew to try to figure out why he sampled this, and he never got back to me. He also samples John Anderson's vocals on a Mike Oldfield song on the first track on this album. He went through a very micro progressive rock period before going totally in their direction. I mean, his next album is much more minimalist. There are strains of this stuff throughout music, and there's one thing I didn't get into the book as much as I wanted, frankly. I researched it and I put a bit in. A lot of this music survived as samples doing something very specific, and not just kind of break beats or little snatches of funk songs that you hear in a lot of hip-hop, but as really spacey, unique soundboards for bands like De La Soul, for Kanye West in that circumstance. Tales of Topographic Oceans, which is this almost impenetrable Yes album with really beautiful sections, I've heard spritzed across hip hop, but not many bands would talk about it. The only people I did, some of the producers, Mr. DJ, who's a producer for Outkast, one of the guys I talked to, and it's just the same thing, going through the record bins, but going through them without prejudice, without saying, well, this music is a genre I'm going to stick away from. I think there's a lot more opportunity there for this, because this, just sonically, the things that these bands do with tempo, with time signature, with electronics, really early on, before a lot of funk is even picking them up, I hear a lot of it and wonder why people aren't ripping it off more. And I guess it's that it's not danceable. It takes a little more insight. It takes a brain like Kanye West to figure out how to make a hook out of something that is so challenging and not lending itself to a frug.
Well, why I'm so happy that you played that call, though, too, is it's also true that if you went into my high school in the 1980s amongst progressive rock fans, we would reject the idea that we could listen to hip-hop, right? That wasn't part of our vocabulary. We were defining ourselves at the time based on a type of music that had pretty strict boundaries around it, and we could tell you what the boundaries are, and we knew that those boundaries didn't include country western music, they didn't include hip-hop and some other things, just that hip-hop artists and others have embraced it and said, yeah, it's really cool for us to use in our music, probably teaches us a lesson we probably should have learned.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break here. I got tons more questions. And by the way, towards the end of the show, you're going to meet somebody who's still creating a new prog rock, somebody from a band around here who's still loving this style. But before that, we have other things to say. Let's take a break, and let's go out with a little Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Where things are still, just bring water. Perhaps I should explain, you should pardon the expression, the genesis of this show, which is that David Weigel had written, it turned out, he wrote a book about progressive rock the minute we heard about this book, The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock. We realized it was a chance to do a show with John Dankosky about an obsession of his. I think it's fair to call it an obsession in the sense that he's sitting there with all the album covers stored in their little plastic cases. That was well known around the station, perhaps not that well known out there in the rest of the world. So that's one of the reasons we're doing this. So David Weigel, when we talk about progressive rock, and this is something you do deal with in the book, you know, the Beatles in 1967 are essentially a progressive rock band, except they can't be a progressive rock band because I think there's sort of a chain of custody problem, right? You can't have been this incredibly popular band in 1965 with people screaming while you played and pretty girls flinging themselves at you because you've mastered the pop idiom unlike anybody else and then be a prog rock band, right? You have to have always lived on that Roger Dean planet.
And Roger Dean's role in this, the designer of the spacey Yes covers, I give credit to it, because that did capture progressive rock at its peak. The super artistic Hypnosis covers, the H.R. Geiger cover art for ELP, etc. That was like one vector of progressive rock. But the way I kind of frame it for the book is that any rock that grew out of British garage mod music that kind of absorbed psychedelia and then went somewhere else. It couldn't have gone anywhere. So Genesis started as quite a poppy, chart-friendly band with the minor problem that they don't have any hits at first, and then become much more experimental. Yes, start off as sounding a lot like just The Who with more bass in the lead. If you had John Entwistle lead the band instead of Pete Townsend, and they keep experimenting. So people kind of started in much of the similar place and then went in these wild directions. But the ones who define the ethos that did have this kind of this very specific kind of intricate and extraterrestrial art that made it easy to identify. And the concerts were like that, too. I mean, the early concerts, by early I mean like 66, 67, 68, these bands were part of long psychedelic all-night raves and be-ins, right? And by the early 70s, these bands are the sensory experiences where you show up and you're listening to quadraphonic sound inside an arena, or you've got a light show in the case of Hawkwind, a light show in the case of King Crimson. They're just experimenting with what becomes a lot of arena rock in a more structured way. Like if you go see a U2 concert now and see the various things going across the LED screen, these bands kind of did that first. So the things that you might scoff at, the way they're packaged, these covers that look a bit odd 40 years later, that was part of a presentation that was extremely influential in how all of rock, and then, you know, hip-hop too, how all of it presented itself.
But I think also, John, you know, there's this, actually, if people wonder what we talk about around here in the newsroom at WNPR, we had like a 15-minute conversation about Phil Collins the other day. So, and I think Phil Collins is an interesting case in point. So he was the drummer for Genesis, then Peter Gabriel leaves, he becomes the front man, and as David recounts in his book, he then eventually has this solo career where he's incredibly popular. And then people start, like cool people or maybe not so cool people who have some investment in all the stuff that we're talking about right now, start making fun of him and looking down their noses at him. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of this was not that he became popular, but he became popular with the wrong people. He became popular with people who also thought Billy Joel was really cool, and he couldn't be forgiven for that.
Well, a lot of the bands that David talks about in the book, bands like Rush, that I know you don't want to spend too much time on, Colin, because I know you have an aversion to Rush.
It's okay.
But Rush was essentially popular in their way for 40 years. I mean, they could still, they've retired, but they could still sell out concert halls. And so their fans never abandoned the fact that they would try to put out a new record and sell albums and be popular in their way. Phil Collins went to another type of music. He defected from prog rock after changing the sound of the band that he grew up in, and so a lot of fans couldn't forgive him for that, and he went so far into the pop side that it became a joke to people. I will just say that if you listen to Phil Collins' music from the 1980s in isolation, he was a really great pop songwriter. He had some amazing hits, and if you take him away from what he did with or to Genesis over time, I think his work could stand on its own. But the fact is, we remember the fact that he was the drummer singing background vocals during Supper's Ready in the early 1970s with Peter Gabriel wearing a flower costume on his head, and you think, that's where I want my Phil Collins to be. I don't want my Phil Collins to be standing in front of a band with a bunch of horns.
Just to concretize this, let's hear Music Box, somewhat early Genesis. That's from 1971, and I picked it because we actually now, according to our metrics, have 71 listeners left listening to this radio show. No, that's absolutely not true. So this, David Weigel, this movement, this progressive rock, prog rock movement, it kind of does come in waves. And we've really kind of, for the most part, only been talking about that first wave. What's the second wave? Can you describe what that is? And are they just basically guys who grew up listening to the first wave and thinking, hey, I think I want to do that too?
Well, to an extent. I mean, there's this kind of wave and a half with Rush in the late 1970s, with Camel. There are bands that are not quite contemporaries. The band members were teenagers when these bands were touring, but they're inspired by that, and they're inspired by heavy metal and by other things. And then you've got the 80s with the second wave. You have Marillion, Pendragon, not just a kind of flowering of new bands, but a new gradient of this music in progressive metal, which takes a while to get going. And then a new fan base that surprises people. So one character in the book really is the media. It's probably, I write what I know. I've only ever worked in media, but going back through how the press covered this music from the 60s through 2000 or so, The turn in the press was really hard. It was really this music was condemned completely in most rock media starting around 1977. And when Marillion and these bands come back, when some more experimental metal bands come back, they have huge followings right away, and the press doesn't quite know what to do with it. There are fun reviews of the horror the writers for New Musical Express and Sounds have when they see how popular Marillion is playing these 17-minute songs inspired by Beowulf, and sounding a lot in the beginning, just a lot like Genesis. It wasn't clear why this music had found a new following. It was thought to be pretty well buried by that point. And the progressive bands that had existed, even when King Crimson comes back, it's an artistic band, but it is a bit more danceable. Members of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, after they break up, Carl Palmer joins Asia, which is a very forward-facing corporate rock band. We've barely discussed Yes, which also becomes a very poppy and corporate band. So these bands that were more faithful to the original, to the 70s sound, are confusing to a lot of people. And they don't all stay in that mode either. I mean, I think that the least interesting stuff I found in this, and all this research and all this listening, were the bands that just only try to sound for all time like it's 1972. Most progressive rock bands, you know, no matter when they started, end up trying to evolve in a different direction.
There's so much there, John Dankowski, including. We actually have the newest Marillion song here. And by the way, Marillion was probably the most popular of this whole second wave group. And you're sitting there going, but I never heard of them. To which we say, yes. Not the band, yes, but yes, you never heard of them. Because this really was, I mean, there's a way in which they're kind of all marking themselves out in a certain way. They've got these names that either come from, you know, King Arthur or obscure Tolkien work. And they are kind of saying, yes, we belong to a completely different culture from you guys. So what?
Well, I was looking for the Marillion album to bring in to show you here, and I couldn't find it in my collection.
What?
But when you try to describe that a band that you were listening to growing up that you loved, Marillion, and they say, well, what was the name of your favorite record? And you say, it was Script for a Jester's Tear. People immediately tune you out and think, okay, there's something—
Or beat you up.
There's— and they take your lunch money. And I think that that's part of the problem, right? Now, Marillion has evolved over time. Their lead singer, who helped to found the band, left, and they've maintained and put out more pop-oriented music. And I got to say, I don't really keep up with what Marillion is doing these days. There's a lot more interesting music in the world than what Marillion is up to in 2017. But their first couple records, I still love them. And I put them next to my Genesis records because that's the place they occupy in my brain.
All right. Well, let's hear what Marillion's doing right now. That's B2 right there.
Our wide eyes aren't naive. They're a product of a conscious decision. The welcoming smile is the new cool. The key left in the outside of the unlocked door isn't forgiven.
I think I can say with some confidence that we'll never play Marillion at WNPR ever again. So you were here for history being made, in a way. We have to make two quick points here, and we don't have a lot of time to which to do it because I want to bring these young musicians in here to be part of this. So one of them, David Weigel, is, I mean, in a way, although punk is a rebellion against everything, there's a way in which probably punk is specifically a rebellion against a form of music that is so reliant on expertise, you know, that places expertise and musical acumen above every other possible value. To what degree did, as a kind of counter-reaction, did prog rock beget punk?
I think you put it pretty well, and I go back to the critics. Critics were really raring for something to blow up progressive rock, and they embraced punk for that reason. But when it comes to pretentiousness, a lot of punk, as simple as it was as DIY and back to basics, was also it was very structured in what it was rebelling against, and a little bit art school. There were progressive bands whose members were extremely working class, who resented the fact that 10 years later, these guys who went to much nicer colleges and got their art degrees came out with this post-punk music, punk and post-punk music that was simple, and they found atonal, but in their minds much more pretentious. Not as pretentious, not as big musically, not as ambitious lyrically, but a different kind of pretension. Going back to basic that way, you're making a different kind of statement. I think Greg Lake, who unfortunately has passed away, was one of the guys who resented this the most and just couldn't understand. He understood that not everything ELP was doing by 1978 was great. None of them argued otherwise, but couldn't understand exactly why people did not see this con, that there was really, I'd almost use the word populist, music that was still filling arenas and people flicking their lighters on that really transported you for a couple hours. And then there's this stuff that was kind of clangy, songs about the government and not much interest beyond a couple of minutes. Other people liked it a lot more. People like Robert Fripp and King Crimson really enjoyed watching punk come along and blow this stuff up. And he's living in New York for some of this and actually completely inspired by electronic and this deconstructionism. And that's what I mean. There's a lot of multitudes contained in what we say is progressive.
Mm-hmm. So we've got to take a break right about here just to have time for the final segment. But John Dankosky, we're going to go out with Fleet Foxes. And I think to me, Fleet Foxes is sort of like if Simon and Garfunkel were born 10 years later and started a prog rock band. It would sound something like, but can you, like, in 30 to 45 seconds explain how you connect Fleet Foxes, which might be on a typical normal person's Spotify list, right now to the music we're talking about today.
If you listen to the song structures of any of the Fleet Foxes records, the changing tempos, the suite-like construction of the songs, certainly the orchestral tendencies, big anthems in the middle of these songs, and also some of the lyrical content, it's a pretty straight line to some of the folkier prog rock of the 1970s that I love so much. It's one of the reasons that I truly love this band, and I think that this is more of a follow-up to the prog rock that I loved than some of the bands that maybe would be on the cruise to the edge today.
All right, here we go.
Robert Fripp announced his retirement in 2012, but he announced it in negative 9/16 time, which allows him to continue touring. Today's show is produced by Yarmouth Shipke and me, Wellfleet Sylvester. Amanda Fish appears on Lark's Tongues and Aspic. Our intern is Sarah Bly. The part of Bill Curry was played by Rick Wakeman. And now, back to prog rock.
Yeah, I should tell you that you make your I invented this morning. You make your prog rock name. You pick a town on Cape Cod that's not Provincetown as your first name, and then your childhood pediatrician's last name is your last name. That's your prog rock name. So the question would be, like, you know, would young people still want to play something like this? And here, in the form of a song called Moonbase by 1974, is your answer. Cut this off, but we won't have any time to talk unless I do. So Adam Clymer and Parker Hu are with us. They play guitar and keyboards, respectively, in 1974, a prog rock band from Newington, Connecticut. So Adam Clymer, there's something about the name of your band that prevents people from making fun of you, right?
No, not at all.
You've identified the issue anyway.
Very much so. We've gone back so many times in the band. I think we're split almost down the middle between whether that's the most brilliant name anyone's ever come up with or whether it's the dumbest thing we've ever done. So we will let the audience decide, I suppose.
Right. It's the answer to the question, what do you think this is, 1974?
Yes, it is.
So Parker Hood, tell us. Parker's joining us by phone, but how does a young person, find his or her way to this particular style of music?
Well, if you're asking me personally, I just like to listen to things, and if I like something, I follow it. But, I think that's actually how a lot of people stumble upon new genres of music or new artists or things like that is, I think everyone is born with a certain kind of sensibility that they're attracted to, that they like, you know, musically, and they just find it. I think that's kind of how it goes.
How about you, Adam? Did you have a particular aha band or an aha moment where you thought, oh, that's the musical direction I need to go into?
Oh, absolutely. I remember as if it was yesterday hearing Sgt. Pepper for the very, very first time, and I was young. I mean, young to the point where friends were listening to Sesame Street and things, and this was just one of those moments where it clicked, you know, and from the moment I went through school and college and all that, there was never a question in my world what I wanted to do, how I wanted to do it, and what I wanted to sound like. So coming into 1974 and having the background of the Beatles and Yes and Pink Floyd and Kansas and Rush and all these, you know, the amalgam of what we're calling prog rock today, it was just like, it was meant to be, if we could be a little weird about it.
And Parker, you guys are comfortable with that name, prog rock? I mean, I know it's also very cool to shrug off all titles and genres, but are you guys comfortable with belonging to that tradition?
I may be the wrong person to ask, because this is actually a very new genre of music to me. I actually only ever heard of that term when I was asked to audition for the band 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Adam has a pretty good sense of how the guys feel about it, since they've been really immersed in all of this music and the culture for such a long time.
Did they send you up to John Dankowski's barn and say, just take everything there, bring it home and listen to it, and then eventually you will understand what it is we're trying to do in this band? Hey, David Weigel, you know, your book contains the subtitle Rise and Fall, so we're sort of post-fall now. I assume you're not surprised to find out that in the fertile ground amid the rubble of the old prog rock, young people are finding new stuff to do with it?
No, that was one thing I learned on the cruise. And also, I just think rock in general stopped being the dominant form of pop music a while ago. I mean, I'm 36. I think people in their 20s do not remember when the biggest band you'd see on advertising a product or in the filling a stadium was a rock band. There's a couple left, but they're all hip-hop and pop stars again. So it's kind of heartening that as people have rediscovered vinyl, it's something as simple as that, as kind of rock has been flattened and equalized, there's a little bit less, I think, freedom to follow a trend when everything is kind of archived, when you're going over rock history and there's not a lot of new stuff. So you've seen a lot of bands adopt 80s synthesizer sounds and put that forward into pop music. And you've seen really good, I think, experimental rock that, you know, maybe 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, when the goal was getting like the MTV Buzz Bin, they would have been frowned upon. But it's all open now. I mean, there are people like Ted Leo has a new album that he self-released, who's pretty open about some of the progressive rock influences in how he writes what you might have otherwise called punk rock. But all of rock is kind of playing in the same, I want to say sandbox, it's a little too minimizing, but it's the genre's, I think, been evened out a little bit because the music industry has moved on to other things. And I, as somebody who listens to it, as somebody who goes to tons of concerts, I find it really exciting. And I find like the communities around this stuff to be really supportive in a way that they weren't when there's a little bit more looking over your shoulder about hipness.
I should say, speaking of concerts, 1974 will be playing this Friday night, December 1st, at the R Street Tavern in Hartford. And you'll see John Dankowski leaning up against the wall in his George Martin-like role. How many people are in 1974?
Five of us.
So you'd be the sixth 1974.
Is there a little bit of tongue-in-cheek that you have to bring to being in a 2017 prog rock band? I mean, how much do you balance the earnestness with which you love this music and the fact that a lot of people are going to see it as, you know, a step back in time?
Well, to be honest, we do wear that moniker quite proudly, you know, prog rock and you know, with respect. You know, we say, yes, we're prog rock. But I think if you cornered any one of us, any one of the five of us, and started having a chat about what we do, what we are, and how we define ourselves, I think you'll see us kind of really beat around the bush before we start throwing that term progressive rock out there. Mm-hmm. I feel like we were more or less ordained with that. You know, I think there was a couple of reviews that came around that said, these are progressive, this is the new progressive rock. And I said, really? You know, I think in the sense of how we write our stories and how we write our music and stuff, yeah, okay, a lot of influences and nothing gets thrown out.
But I want to have a little time to end with something by 1974. This is Swan Song of the Enemy, which everybody has been dialing up on our request line to ask. We have a request line now to ask for.
It's just my parents. We'll be right back.
What if progressive rock is really regular rock, and we haven't progressed enough?